Chapter 18. The Wisdom of Renunciation and Liberation. Verses 1 and 2.
Arjuna uvacha. Sanyasasya mahabaho tattvamichhami veditum yagasya cha hrishikesha prithakkeshi nishudana. Shri Bhagavan uvacha. Kamyanam karmanam nyasam sanyasam kavayo viduhu. Sarva karma palatyagam rahustyagam vichakshanaha.
Arjuna said, O mighty armed one, I wish to know the essence of renunciation and of relinquishing the fruits. O Lord of senses, destroyer of sin. The Blessed Lord said, The wise have known that abandoning the desire-fulfilling observances is renunciation. The insightful ones say that relinquishing the fruits of all actions is relinquishing. The actions that are helpful and liberating in the path of spirituality have been described. Now, Arjuna wants to better understand the profound teachings of the path of renunciation, sannyasa, and of the path of renouncing the fruits of one's actions, tyaga. Aspirants who renounce the desire for pleasure are called sannyasins, and those who perform their duties skillfully and selflessly, giving up the fruits of their actions, are called karma yogis. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that there are characteristic differences between renunciates and those who perform actions but renounce the fruits. However, from time immemorial, there have been two paths, the path of renunciation and the path of action. The majority of people in the world follow the path of action. Only the rare and fortunate few walk the path of renunciation. Only those who have already burned their desires for self-enjoyment can walk that path. Others should not try. For the ordinary human being, the path of action is the way. When one studies various commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, he finds an intellectual tug-of-war between two groups of commentators, one pulling toward renunciation, and the other toward action. These two paths are distinct and separate, and there is no need to judge one as being better than the other. Those who do are prejudiced and act under the influence of their egos. When one studies the message of the Bhagavad Gita, he realizes that all knowledge originates from one source and finally leads one to that source. That source is pure Atman, from which springs the entire knowledge and toward which it flows through various avenues, until it finally meets its source, the ocean of happiness, bliss, and peace. The Bhagavad Gita's message ends in this 18th chapter, which is conclusive and decisive. When he replies to Arjuna's questions, Sri Krishna answers the questions of all aspirants. Which is the path that leads one to the immutable, unchangeable, everlasting bliss? Which is the path that should be followed? What is renunciation, and what is action? Many commentators have drawn certain conclusions because they themselves lust for the enjoyments of the world, and because they think that since the majority of people of the world follow the path of action, it is superior to the path of renunciation. But to know truth, one does not need the support of an army of people. Truth can and should be attained in all possible ways. To attain the absolute truth, there are various paths that lead to the same summit. It is of no use to create a war of arguments, attempting to prove one path superior or inferior to another. In the ancient tradition, the organization of one's life was guided by the thought that one would live for at least 100 years. The first 25 years were devoted to school and learning. In the next 25, one attempted to understand relationships and interaction with others and the creatures of the world, The third quarter of one's life was dedicated to understanding the values of life with its currents and cross-currents. The last 25 were devoted to spiritual sadhana alone. One would completely wash off the past. He would renounce and become totally non-attached, dedicating himself to the Supreme Self alone. These last 25 years were devoted to self-realization. With that systematic way of living, one finally attained the purpose of life. That was considered to be the normal procedure. But even during ancient times, a few enlightened ones joined monasteries from a very early age, renounced the normal course of life, and attained self-realization. The path of renunciation is meant for only a few, and those who are not prepared should not tread that path. Those who learn to dedicate the fruits of all actions to the Lord and for the well-being of others are on the path. Those who renounce both actions and their fruits also follow the path to self-realization. In the path of renunciation, all action is renounced. Therefore, the desire to receive the fruits of action is renounced as well. But in the path of action, action is not renounced. Only the fruits are surrendered. The question might arise, is it possible for anyone to renounce all actions? This can be answered with another question. When all the actions, desires, and motivations for self-enjoyment are renounced, what is the action to be done, and what is the purpose of doing actions? There remains only one action, doing action for the welfare of others. That action which is not done for one's own pleasure, but only for the well-being of others, does not have the power of bondage. Therefore, such action is allowed to be done in the path of renunciation. Those who follow the path of action believe that actions such as yajna, charity, and austerities are liberating actions that should be performed. And in the path of renunciation, actions such as meditation, contemplation, and prayer are done with the motivation of attaining liberation. Although it is important and a must in the path of renunciation, liberation is only a step towards self-realization. After one has liberated himself from the bondage of all attachment, he has yet to attain unity with the self of all. Liberating the individual self from the bondage of attachment is not the same as attaining samadhi or self-realization. Even if one performs actions that are liberating and that do not create further bondage, he still remains an individual and has yet to reach a higher state. He has to learn to expand consciousness and go on expanding it until he realizes universal consciousness. The goal of the renunciate is to systematically fathom one after another of the various stages of consciousness that lead to the innermost one. The following principles are the basis of the path of renunciation. 1. The renunciate directs all his energy toward the attainment of the goal of life, self-realization. 2. He does not waste time and energy pursuing desires based on self-interest. 3. The renunciate's journey is inward. It is neither action nor inaction nor retreat. It consists of performing actions mentally and directing the mind and its modifications inward rather than toward the external world. 4. Non-attachment is attained spontaneously, because the renunciate is not involved with objects. They have all been consciously renounced. 5. With pure reason, all the samskaras are burned in the fire of knowledge. 6. There remains only one desire, the desire for self-realization. That desire does not motivate one to do actions in the external world, but becomes a means to build determination, willpower, and one-pointedness. Therefore, such desire is an essential means rather than an obstacle in the path of sadhana. 7. In the path of renunciation, self-realization alone is the goal, and any action that does not become a means is firmly rejected and renounced. There is no half here and half there. Total dedication and devotion are essential limbs for renunciation. This path of the rare few is the highest of all. It is difficult, but not impossible. Those who are fully prepared should walk this path of fire and light. They should not listen to the suggestions of those who are not capable of following the path of renunciation. Those who are not prepared to become renunciates should not think that they cannot realize the self. That which is important to understand and attain is the state of non-attachment, without which treading either path, renunciation or action, is meaningless. It is important to do actions and duties for the common good, and to release oneself from the helpless and inevitable law of karma. Such actions become a means to self-realization, provided the goal always remains foremost and one's actions are performed with zeal to offer all the fruits to the Lord. That brings freedom from the law of karma. Dedicating all the fruits of action to the Lord is meditation in action, a central theme of the Bhagavad Gita, inspiring Arjuna and all aspirants. In the path of action, self-realization is said to be attained by performing actions that are not binding, that are performed for the Lord alone. No path is superior or inferior. That which is important is to attain the wisdom of non-attachment. Verses 3 through 6.
Yajyam doshavaditieke karma prahur manishinaha yajnyadana tapah karma natyajyam iti chapare nischayam shrunume tatra tyage bharata sattama yagohi purushavyagra trividha samprakirtitaha. Yajnyadana tapah karma natyajyam karyameva tat yajnyodanam tapaschaiva pavanani manishinam etanyapi tu karmani sangam tyaktva phalani cha kartavyani iti me partha nischitam matamuttamam.
Some contemplative thinkers say that action should be abandoned like a fault. Others say that sacrifice, charity, and ascetic actions cannot be relinquished. In this regard, hear my determination concerning relinquishment, O best of Bharatas. O tiger among men, relinquishment indeed is said to be of three kinds: sacrifice, charity, and asceticism. These acts should not be abandoned. Indeed, they must be done. Sacrifice, charity, and asceticism are purifiers of the contemplative and the wise. Even these acts, however, should be performed after abandoning fruits. O son of Pritha, this is my definite view. Some learned men say that all actions should be given up because actions lead one to an endless chain of reactions, thus creating a whirlpool for the performer of the actions. Once one is caught in that whirlpool, it is difficult to come out of it. There is another group of learned people who believe that good actions should not be abandoned because they need not create bondage. According to them, there are two kinds of works. One leads to bondage, and the other does not. Describing both renunciation and action, Sri Krishna advises Arjuna to perform actions without any attachment in order to establish righteousness. He says that the three practices of yajna, charity, and austerity are righteous actions. Those actions performed with non-attachment and without the desire to enjoy the fruits should be practiced by those who cannot follow the path of renunciation. Verses 7 through 9.
Niyatasyutu sannyasaha karmano nopapadyate मोहात्तस्य परित्यागस्तामसपरिकीर्तितः। दुःखमित्येव यत्कर्म कार्यक्लेशभयात् त्यजेत् स कृत्वा राजसं त्यागं नैव त्यागफलं लभेत्। कार्यमित्येव यत्कर्म नियतं क्रियतेऽर्जुन संगं त्यक्त्वा फलं चैव स त्यागः सात्विको मतः।
It is not appropriate to renounce the eternal act. To abandon that out of delusion is said to be tamasic. If one abandons an act because it is difficult, and out of a fear of discomfort to the body, upon committing such rajasic abandonment, one would not gain the result of abandoning. The act that is ever performed because it ought to be done, O Arjuna, giving up attachment as well as the fruit, such relinquishment is considered sattvic. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that one should not renounce his duty under the influence of either rajas or tamas. Those who renounce their duties under the spell of confusion, delusion, or disappointment cannot tread the path of renunciation, but descend to the darkness of ignorance. Giving up one's duty in a fit of emotion is tamasic renunciation, which inevitably creates misery. Those who renounce based on such motivation become a burden to themselves, to their nation, and to the whole of mankind. They remain dependent on others for their livelihood and become poor examples to others. Sattvikas alone are capable of treading the rare path of renunciation. Rajasic and tamasic people should first learn to practice sattva. They should do their duties and should never, out of disappointment or in a fit of emotion or excitement, think of treading the path of light. Those who are under the sway of rajas are afraid of afflictions, and their thoughts of losing and not gaining cause them serious pain. It is fear that causes them to give up actions. They search for pleasure by making efforts only to attain their selfish ends. If one renounces the world because of fear or pain, he gives a bad name to the path of fire and knowledge. Tamasic people are known for their inertia and sloth. Their inactivity creates misery for themselves and others. They are not fit for either the path of renunciation or the path of action. They believe in eat, drink, and be merry, and remain unconscious of both the internal and external realities. For escape, they use all sorts of intoxicants. The sattvic aspirants never renounce their essential duties, whether they follow the path of renunciation or the path of action. They work hard, perform their duties skillfully, and even learn to suffer to make others happy. Sattvikas are the rare people who are successful and always have clarity of mind. Rajasikas are confused, and tamasikas are ignorant. Verses 10 through 12.
Nadveshtya kushalam karma kushale nanushajjate, tyagi sattva samavishto medhavi chinna samshayaha. नहि देह भृता शक्यं त्यक्तुं कर्माण्यशेषतः यस्तु कर्म फलत्यागी सत्यागीत्यभिधीयते। अनिष्टं इष्टं मिश्रं च त्रिविधं कर्मणः फलं भवत्यत्यागिनां प्रेत्य न तु संन्यासिनां क्वचित्।
A relinquisher possessed of mental essence, endowed with intuitive wisdom, with his doubts dispelled, neither hates the unhappy deed, nor is drawn to the happy act. It is not at all possible for a body-bearer to abandon acts in their entirety. He, however, who relinquishes the fruits of action, is said to be the relinquisher. The fruit of action is threefold: undesirable, desirable, and mixed. Such fruit accrues after death to those who do not relinquish, but to the renunciates there is none. Those aspirants who are endowed with the qualities of sattva, who are free from all doubts, do not withdraw themselves from disagreeable work and do not become attached to pleasant work. For them, duty is duty, and they perform their duties with an even mind. It is not possible for the ordinary human being to abstain from his duties, for he carries his samskaras from his previous lives. He has those latent tendencies within himself that create his duties, and sooner or later they have to be performed. There is no choice but to perform one's duty, but one can choose to renounce the fruits of his actions. The aspirants who do not relinquish the fruits of their actions receive those fruits, but they are uncertain as to what they will be. Some fruits are agreeable, some are unpleasant, and some are mixed. Those who perform their actions selflessly and skillfully, dedicating all the fruits of their actions, remain unaffected here and hereafter. Verses 13 through 15.
Panchaitani mahabaho karanani nibodhame sankhye kritante proktani siddhaye sarvakarmanam adishthanam tatha karta karanam cha prithagvidham vividhascha prithakchesta daivam chaivatra panchamam sharirvang manobhiryat karma prarabhate narah nyayam va viparitam va panchaite tasya hetavah.
Learn these five causes from me, O mighty armed one, taught in Sankhya, where all actions end, for the fulfillment of all actions. The substratum, the agent of action, and instrumentality of different kinds, separate motions of various kinds, and the rulership of the deities as the fifth. The actions that a human initiates with the body, speech, and mind, whether just or its opposite. These five are its causes. According to Sankhya philosophy and science, when an aspirant performs action from a state of equilibrium, it is accomplished without any obstacle. Sankhya explains that five factors are necessary for accomplishing an action. First, the doer of actions needs a field for his actions and a dwelling place, called the adhisthana. The second important factor is the performer of the actions who dwells within the field. He should be skilled in the performance. The third factor is the means and instruments of various kinds that are used by the performer. To attain the desired fruit, it is necessary to have health and appropriate means. The fourth factor is effort. For if a concentrated effort is not made, the desire to accomplish something is wasted. The undertaking should be well planned, and effort should be applied skillfully. The fifth factor is a favorable circumstance. Good actions performed in past lives give one the opportunity to be reborn in a family, environment, and country that offer favorable circumstances. Some people think that a favorable circumstance is the result of luck. But luck is not a non-human factor. It is not partiality shown toward any one particular individual by a supreme being. A favorable circumstance is self-created. The Bhagavad Gita gives this as the last factor. Human endeavor, sincerity, and effort are the principal virtues, and favorable circumstances follow accordingly. Luck is the joy obtained after one's task has been performed successfully, with skill and selflessness. Luck is within the domain of the individual and not in the hands of Providence. Those who are not aware of the actions they have done in the past to bring about their present good circumstances call it luck and attribute it to chance or to Providence. Verses 16 and 17.
Tatraivam sati kartaram atmanam kevalam tu yaha pashyat yakrita buddhitvan nasapashyati durmatihi. Yasya naham kruto bhavo buddhir yasya nalipyate. Hatvapi sa iman lokan nahanti nanibadyate.
This being the reality, he who sees only the self as the agent, because he has not cultivated his wisdom, such a dull wit does not see. He who does not have the sentiment produced by the thought, I, whose intelligence is not defiled, even upon killing these beings, he neither kills nor is bound. Sankhya philosophy and science declares that five factors are important for accomplishing an act: place, agent, means, effort, and circumstance. Those who do not understand this truth are inflated with pride. They think that they are the doers. Such people are ignorant and unwise. False pride feeds the ego, which creates the last obstruction in the path of self-realization. In fact, all the negative emotions feed the ego, creating a serious barrier that separates a person from the whole. The aspirant who does not have a feeling of egoism, who has completely surrendered himself, his deeds, and the fruits of his actions to his single goal, the Supreme Lord, is not considered to be an evildoer, even if he kills someone in the battlefield, because he has profound knowledge of life, love, and equality, and his actions are completely dedicated to the Lord. He is free from the I-ness of his ego, and is a representative of the Lord. He has no intention to injure, hurt, harm, or kill anyone. While protecting the boundaries of their country, soldiers fight for their national cause and kill intruders, yet they are not considered to be killers and murderers. When one who is selfless kills someone while performing his duty, his mind remains unstained, and he is not bound by the law of karma, for he has gone beyond the bounds of individuality and remains one with the Lord. Of course, this should not promote fanaticism. Those who are narrow-minded sometimes become religious fanatics and think that they can misuse this scriptural injunction for their own selfish convenience. The yogi who practices ahimsa with mind, action, and speech never dreams of killing anyone. The question here is whether Arjuna should retire or fight the battle of life. When Arjuna, a hero and leader of a nation, becomes despondent and shrinks from his duty in the battlefield, Sri Krishna teaches him not to resign, but to fight, for it is the battle of life in which all human beings are participants. All aspirants are fighters. To attain the highest goal, one needs courage, strength, and zeal to fight. That is the true meaning of these verses. Verses 18 and 19.
Jnanam jneyam parijnata trividha karma chodana. Karanam karma karteti trividha karma sangraha. Jnanam karma cha karta cha tridhaiva gunabhedataha. Prochyate guna sankhyane yathavat shrunutanyapi.
Knowledge, the object of knowledge, and the knower. This is the threefold source of impelling the action: the instrument, the act, and the agent. This is the threefold gathering of action. The knowledge, action, and doer are said to be of three types through the distinction of gunas, as is taught in the way of discriminating gunas correctly. Hear of these also. To live in the world, these three are needed: the object of knowledge, the knower, and the instrument. Actions cannot be performed without these three essentials. One must have profound knowledge of them for the accomplishment of any work. Each of these is again divided according to the gunas. Verses 20 through 22.
ಸರ್ವಭೂತೇಷು ಏನೈಕಂ ಭಾವಂ ಅವ್ಯಯ ಮೀಕ್ಷ್ಯತೆ ಅವಿಭಕ್ತಂ ವಿಭಕ್ತೇಷು ತಜ್ಞಾನಂ ವಿದ್ಧಿ ಸಾತ್ವಿಕಂ ಪೃಥಕ್ತ್ವೇನ ತು ಯಜ್ಞಾನಂ ನಾನಾಭಾವಾನ್ ಪೃಥಗ್ವಿಧಾನ್ ವೇತ್ತಿ ಸರ್ವೇಷು ಭೂತೇಷು ತಜ್ಞಾನಂ ವಿದ್ಧಿ ರಾಜಸಂ ಯತ್ತು ಕೃತ್ಸ್ನವದೇಕಸ್ಮಿನ್ ಕಾರ್ಯೇ ಸಕ್ತಂ ಅಹೈತುಕಂ ಅತತ್ವಾರ್ಥವದಲ್ಪಂ ಚ ತತ್ತಾಮಸಮುದಾಹೃತಂ
That whereby one sees a single, immutable aspect in all beings, undivided in the divided, know that to be the sattvic knowledge. When one knows the knowledge and all the separate kinds of aspects, each divided separately among all beings, know that to be the rajasic knowledge. That which is attached to a single effort, as though it were the entire, without proper reasoning, devoid of essential meaning and reality, and narrow in scope, is said to be tamasic. Knowledge is of a threefold nature. Aspirants who have cultivated sattva know that the self is not subject to change, death, or decomposition. Such aspirants have gone beyond the limitations of ignorance and have acquired the knowledge of the whole. Because they have profound knowledge of the whole, they do not suffer from limited and divided vision. For them, birth and death are not occasions for either sadness or joy, pleasure or pain. The knowledge that prompts one to see the single whole as many has a rajasic quality. There is another kind of knowledge, tamasic, that does not even recognize multiplicity. It only sees and reacts to what is immediately beneficial. Those possessed of this form of knowledge do not think of the consequences of their actions. They are engrossed in sensual pleasures and act impulsively. Such people treat a part as the whole. Selfishness blinds their vision, and they remain in the darkness of ignorance. Verses 23 through 25.
Niyatam sangarahitam aragadveshatakritam aphalaprepsuna karma yattat sattvikamuchyate yattu kamepsuna karma sahankarena vapunaha kriyate bahulayasam tad rajasamudahrutam anubandham kshayam himsam anavekshyacha paurusham ಮೋಹಾದಾರಭ್ಯತೆ ಕರ್ಮ ಯತ್ತತ್ತಾಮಸಮುಚ್ಯತೆ.
An act performed devoid of attachment and without attraction and aversion by one desiring no fruit is called sattvic. That act, however, which is performed by one desirous of fruit and possessed with ego, with much exertion of many kinds, that is called rajasic. Without foreseeing the result, loss, violence, or capacity, the act that is initiated out of delusion is called tamasic. All actions are divided into three classes. Sattvic actions are those that are performed selflessly, the fruits being dedicated and offered to the Lord. All yoga practices, including physical exercise, pranayama, and meditation, are considered to be sattvic actions. Prayers, chanting, and charity done selflessly are sattvic in nature. Actions that are not performed with non-attachment but with desire for self-gratification are rajasic. Such actions are performed with great strain and are enveloped by selfish and egotistical desires. That way of being leads one to be chronically anxious and tense. The majority of people in modern society suffer under the strains of actions motivated by rajas. If modern therapy were to concentrate on helping one develop a sattvic way of being, many of the physical disorders and much of the psychological stress that we see would be eliminated. Tamasic actions are those undertaken without regard for the consequences. The tamasic person stumbles along, reacting to the moment, without regard to the havoc he creates as a result of his capacities or limitations. He may think that he is capable of much more than he really is, and thus injures himself and others. Or he may believe that he is incapable, and thus becomes inert and fail to act. Although such people are unpredictable, one can accurately predict that the results of their actions will be disastrous. Verses 26 through 28.
Mukta sango naham vadi drutyutsaha samanvitaha siddhya siddhyor nirvikaraha karta satvika uchyate ragi karma phala prepsur lubdho himsatmako shuchihi harsha shokanvitak karta rajasa parikirtitaha ayuktaha prakritaha stabdaha shato naishkrutiko lasaha vishadi dirghasutri cha karta tamasa uchyate.
Liberated from attachment, not uttering I, endowed with the power to sustain and enthuse, unaffected in fulfillment or failure, such an actor is said to be sattvic. Attached, desirous of the fruit of action, greedy, inclined to violence, impure, possessed by exhilaration and depression, such an actor is said to be rajasic. Not joined in yoga, unrefined, unbending, a rogue, harming others, lazy, always depressed, a procrastinator. Such an actor is said to be tamasic. One who is endowed with the sattva quality is free from attachment and egoism. He is courageous and enthusiastic. With even-mindedness, he functions and does his duty. He maintains equilibrium all the time. He is neither inflated by success nor depressed by failure. A man of equilibrium is an example for society, for society needs something more concrete than the teachings of the scriptures. Such people are great assets. By contrast, people who are endowed with a rajasic nature are active and work selfishly for sense gratification. They are greedy people and are harmful to society, for they believe in possessing and hoarding. They readily experience fluctuations of joy and sorrow in their daily lives. They have no control of the mind and senses. Their desires are selfish. Such people do everything for the sake of selfish ends. Those who are tamasic do not have any concern for the existence of others. They are inactive, lazy, and hurt and harm others. To obtain sensual joy, they will commit any heinous crime. They are the worst examples in society. After describing three kinds of performers of actions, Sri Krishna distinguishes between three types of intelligence, buddhi, and three types of resolution or firmness, dritti. Among the four main instruments of antakarana, buddhi is the discriminative, judging, and deciding faculty through which the light of knowledge comes forward. It is through buddhi that one discriminates and understands, judges, and makes decisions before he performs actions. There are three kinds of buddhi. The buddhi that helps one to discriminate, judge, and decide, to know right from wrong, and to understand what is to be feared and what is not to be feared, is called sattvic buddhi. Sattvic buddhi leads the aspirant inward and helps him to fathom the subtler and higher realms of life. Without any distraction, the pure reason of buddhi becomes penetrative and fathoms those levels of life that normally remain unknown to ordinary human beings. The higher, or sattvic buddhi, has the following characteristics. 1. The power of discrimination is developed. 2. The buddhi that has learned to discriminate between the self and non-self, between the supreme self in its unmanifest state and its power of manifestation, possesses the power of non-attachment. 3. Such a buddhi has one-pointedness and inwardness. 4. It has attained calmness, quietness, and steadiness. It remains serene, undisturbed, and undissipated. 5. It is free from the desire for sense gratification. 6. It helps one to decide right from wrong and to act in a timely manner. 7. It makes one selfless and giving without any expectations. 8. It helps one to remain tranquil and even in all conditions. 9. It helps one to remain a witness. 10. It leads one to spiritual heights. Verses 29 through 32.
Buddher bhedam dhuteshchaiva gunatas trividham shrunu rochyamanam asheshena pruthaktvena dhananjaya. Pravruttim cha nivruttim cha karya karye bhaya bhaye bandham moksham cha ya vetti buddhissapartha sattviki. Yaya dharmam adharmam cha karyam cha karyam eva cha ayathavat prajanati buddhissapartha rajasi. Adharmam dharmam iti ya manyate tamasavruta, sarvarthan viparitanscha, buddhissa partha tamasi.
Now, hear the threefold division of intelligence and sustenance by their gunas, being taught in entirety and separately, O Arjuna. Ordinance and prohibition, what ought to be done or not to be done. Dangerous and non-dangerous, bondage and liberation. The intelligence that knows these, O son of Pritha, is the sattvic one. That by which one knows incorrectly virtue and vice, what ought to be done or ought not to be done, O son of Pritha, is rajasic. That intelligence which, covered by darkness, believes vice to be virtue, and all the matters opposite of their reality, O son of Pritha, is tamasic. The buddhi that is of a rajasic quality is incapable of helping one distinguish that which is the righteous path from that which is not. It is unable to discriminate between the real and the unreal. However, the rajasic buddhi is important for gaining external knowledge. Mechanical and scientific knowledge, knowledge of business, and knowledge relating to any aspect of the external world is a result of rajasic buddhi. It is not possible for anyone to function in the external world without it. People of a tamasic nature are ignorant and remain engrossed in sense enjoyment. They act in a manner opposite and contrary to the sattvic quality. Tamasic knowledge leads one to sullenness, sloth, and inertia. The aspirant should not forget that the three gunas always function together in human life. The difference between one person and another is in the relative strength of each quality. The most important factor is which quality is predominant. If sattva is predominant, life becomes peaceful, joyful, and delightful. If rajas is predominant, one becomes active and hyper, prone to restlessness, and may suffer from psychosomatic and psychological illnesses. If tamas is predominant, everything in life becomes negative and passive. Then one does not experience any happiness or joy. The predominance of one or another of these three qualities is clearly noticed in human behavior. Those who have gone beyond the three gunas, who have realized the self, and who remain in a state of samadhi, are rarely seen. They do exist in our world, but they are one in 100 million. Those great ones guide humanity in a subtle and profound way, emanating their love and knowledge through their minds, actions, and speech. Verses 33 through 35.
Dhritya yaya dharayate manah pranendriya kriyaha योगेनाव्यभिचारिण्या धृतिस्सा पार्थ सात्विकी। यया तु धर्मकामार्थान् धृत्या धारयतेऽर्जुन प्रसंगेन फलाकांक्षी धृतिस्सा पार्थ राजसी। यया स्वप्नं भयं शोकं विषादं मदमेव च न विमुञ्चति दुर्मेधा धृतिस्सा पार्थ तामसी।
That undeviating steadfastness, dhriti, which sustains activities of mind, prana, and senses through yoga, is, O Pritha, a sattvic one. That by which one sustains virtue, desire, and worldly success, desiring fruits incidentally in the context, that steadfastness, dhriti, is rajasic. That by which someone devoid of intuitive wisdom does not give up sleep, fear, grief, and depression, that steadfastness, dhriti, O son of Pritha, is tamasic. In addition to intelligence and knowledge, dhriti, firmness or steadiness, is necessary in the path to infinity. There are aspirants who have knowledge, who know what to do and what not to do, but who lack the inner strength to be steady and firm in doing their practices. Some aspirants are very steady and firm, but do not have profound knowledge of spirituality. In the path to self-realization, sattvic buddhi and sattvic firmness are equally important. The way it is used here, the word dhriti has a meaning more profound than that which is usually attributed to it. It is that inner strength which does not dawn all of a sudden, but which is attained only after long spiritual practice under the guidance of an accomplished yogi. Human effort, sincerity, and honesty lead the aspirant to attain that power. For lack of that power, the yogi cannot reach the highest realm of spiritual knowledge. Dhriti enables one to have a one-pointed mind, and it helps one maintain coordination between the mind and the vital breath and pranic energy. It is a method of applying sushumna, which is important for attaining spiritual knowledge and a state of tranquility, for all inner and external distractions are controlled by sushumna application. Those who systematically learn the method of meditation know that after attaining physical stillness and steadiness, irregularity of the breath continues to disturb the mind. Mental unrest can also disrupt the breath. Breath and mind are two inseparable friends who work together until the last breath of life. An in-depth study of the breath has not yet been undertaken by modern scientists, but the yogis know the subtle function of the breath and are aware that irregular breathing agitates the mind, and vice versa. When the breath is calm and serene, when it has no jerks and no long pauses, it does not distract the mind, but creates feelings of intense joy and steadiness. The state in which both mind and breath function in a balanced way is established by dhriti. Dhriti is that which brings mind and breath to a state of balance. It is the power that helps them to work together in a serene way. If one is not able to regulate his mind and breathe in a perfectly coordinated way, his meditation will not bear the desired fruit, samadhi, no matter how many hours he practices meditation. When one's posture is comfortable, still, and steady, and when the mind is focused on the bridge between the nostrils, then sushumna is applied. Prior to the application of sushumna, the practice of even breathing, alternate nostril breathing, and inner and outer retention of the breath should be perfected. These exercises should be practiced only under the guidance of a yogi, not just with instructions from books and manuals. Firmness or determination is of three kinds: sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic. It is sattvic when it is able to direct the power of mind, senses, and breath to bring about balance. And when the mind and breath mutually help one another in a coordinated way. It is sattvic when used for spiritual attainment and selfless actions. When used for selfish desire and self-enjoyment, it is rajasic. Rajas-endowed dhriti prompts one to perform actions or religious act with a desire to enjoy the fruits of those actions. Tamasic dhriti produces excessive and long hours of sleep with numerous and disturbing dreams. It also creates fears, makes one timid and sorrowful, and leads one to cry without valid reason. It makes one arrogant and self-conceited. The firmness of tamasic people is expressed in obstinacy and conceit. Psychotherapists encounter tamasic dhriti in the passive-aggressive personality, in clients who show willful resistance and negativity, and in those who tenaciously hold on to their symptomatic behaviors despite their superficial pleas that their therapists rid them of such behaviors. If the therapist can help such clients to use that firmness in the context of rajas and sattva, that force which is being used in a negative way can serve a positive and useful function. It is not to be eliminated, but rather to be redirected so that it becomes an instrument to help one achieve positive goals. Verses 36 through 39.
Sukham tvidanim trividam shrunume bharatarshava abhyasat ramate yatra dukkantam cha nigacchati yatta dagre vishamiva pariname mrutopamam tat sukham sattvikam proktam atma buddhi prasadajam vishayendriya sanyogat yatta dagre mrutopamam pariname vishamiva tat sukham rajasam smrutam Yadagre chanubandhe cha sukham mohanamatmana nidralasya pramadottam tattamasam udakrutam.
Now hear from me the three kinds of happiness in which one delights through practice and definitely finds the end of sorrow. That which initially is like poison, but is in effect like elixir, that happiness is called sattvic, born of the pleasantness of one's intelligence. That which appears initially like elixir, through the union of senses and their objects, but in effect is like a poison, that happiness is considered rajasic. That happiness with both initially and in the end result deludes oneself, arising from sleep, laziness, and inattention, that is said to be the tamasic. These verses describe three kinds of joy. When first encountered, the highest joy seems like a poison, or at least a bitter medicine to those who are used to the gross worldly pleasure. But when one becomes familiar with its subtle qualities, that joy becomes a nectar, a joy so subtle that it cannot be imagined by one who has tasted only worldly pleasures. It is said, a bitter pill has a blessed effect, and such is the case with sattvic joy. What is joy? That which makes one happy. That which is not disturbing or painful is joy. The whole of mankind and creatures of this universe are searching for perennial joy. They seem to find a bit of it in relating to different objects of the world, but alas, those joys soon diminish for two reasons. The object of joy changes, and the enjoyer's concept of joy also changes. Nothing is permanent in the mundane and temporal world. Creatures other than human beings are controlled by nature, but human beings have a will of their own and a power unique in itself that helps them to continue in search of the imperishable, unfettered joy. When one becomes tired of the fleeting joys of the mundane world, he looks and searches within, in his inner world, which he has never tried to know and understand. In the inner world, there is a fountain that ultimately quenches the thirst of those seekers who genuinely search for it. If the seeker gets the opportunity and learns the way of fathoming all the levels of life, he will find that there is a source, and that there are profound ways to go to that source, from which flows perennially the joy divine. Discontent is seen on the face of everyone. No one seems to be happy and joyous, even if they have all the desired objects of the world. But the day comes when one awakens to the reality that searching in the external world is in vain, that only the search within is rewarding and satisfying. Then one begins following the path of the inward journey. The Bhagavad Gita says that when the individual self finds delight and joy in the self, that is the highest of all joys. It is called love without an object, meditation without form, love without desire, and meditation without an obstacle. That is sattva-endowed joy. Such joy is born only after the serenity of self-knowledge is attained. All the pleasure experienced by the senses is but momentary, and it is also the source of pain. But the profound joy that is attained by self-realization is permanent and everlasting, for the self knows no pain, no misery, and no worry. The joy experienced by rajas-endowed people arises from the contact of the senses with the objects of the world. It is relished like nectar in the beginning, but it is like poison in the end. Tamasic pleasure deludes the human mind in both the beginning and the end. It springs from the ignorance of sleep, laziness, and negligence. Verse 40.
Natadasti prithivyam va divi deveshu va punaha sattvam prakriti jair muktam yadebhisyat tribirgunaihi.
There is no essence in the earth, in heaven, or even among gods, that may be free of these nature-born gunas. All that exists on this earth, in the sky, and in the heavens, is enveloped by the three gunas. These three qualities stage a drama for mankind, and all kinds of people participate in that drama. Some are called sattvic, some rajasic, and some tamasic. Everyone plays his role according to his nature. Verses 41 through 44.
Brahmana kshatriya visham shudranam cha parantapa karmani pravibhaktani swabhava prabhavair gunaihi shamo damas tapas shaucham kshanti rajavam eva cha jnanam vijnanam astikyam brahma karma swabhavajam shauryam tejo dhrutir dakshyam yuddhe chapya palayanam danam ishvara bhavascha kshatram karma swabhavajam Krushi gaurakshya vanijyam, vaishya karma swabhavajam, paricharyatmakam karma shudrasyapi swabhavajam.
The actions of the brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras, O scorcher of enemies, are properly divided by the gunas born of the primordial nature prakriti. Peace, control, asceticism, purity, forgiveness, simplicity, knowledge, realization, and positive belief are the actions of a Brahmana produced by nature. Bravery, confidence, steadfastness, dexterity, not escaping a battle, charity, and expressing sovereign power are the actions of a Kshatriya born of nature. Farming, husbandry, and trading are the actions of a Vaishya, born of nature, and the actions of a Shudra, consisting of service, are also born of nature. Sri Krishna describes four kinds of people according to their innate qualities and dispositions. Birth does not take place by chance. It is not accidental. Our desires and actions from the past lead us to our circumstances, abilities, and desires in this birth. And that which we desire and do now determines our future. We experience desires, and we also act according to the qualities or samskaras that we carry from our past. We carry our samskaras from here to the hereafter, and are reborn according to our own choices. As we have already noted, human beings can be broadly divided into four categories according to their inherent qualities and dispositions. In the Bhagavad Gita, they are called Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. The Brahmana quality is found in spiritually inclined people who know that the purpose of life is to attain tranquility. These aspirants practice self-restraint and self-control, and they gain knowledge of both the internal and external worlds. They also have a profound knowledge of life here and hereafter. They are endowed with the sattva quality because they have strengthened that quality in the past. These brahmanas are called brahmanas not because they have inherited wisdom from their ancestors, but because they have cultivated that disposition with sincere efforts in their past lives. Sattva is not received through inheritance, but it is the result of one's own efforts. Many times we find that a vagabond or ill-mannered and irresponsible person is born into a family of brahmanas, and often a man of brahmanic qualities and disposition is born into a shudra family. It is said that everyone is like a shudra by birth, but one becomes a brahmana only by his own efforts. It is one's samskaras that create his disposition. One who has the qualities of a brahmana is led toward a virtuous and spiritual way of life, and he is able to teach the art and science of life. Rajasic qualities are seen in the personalities of kshatriyas. They have valor, courage, and the ability to administer and rule. The rajasic quality and disposition leads one toward an active and creative way of life. The Vaishyas are another class of people. They are less endowed with sattvic and rajasic qualities than the people in the first two categories. They like to trade and conduct business. Shudra is the category of people who are not fit enough to tread the path of spirituality. They do not have zeal to be active. They lack courage, and they are not fit for trade and business. Their duty is that of service. In ancient times, this division into classes was the basis for the distribution of labor. It was designed for the well-being of society. One's position and work was determined according to the qualities he possessed. Over time, however, this concept of categorizing individuals according to their abilities has become distorted and used to separate people based on their caste, color, race, culture, or religion. That creates both psychological divisiveness and conflicts in the individual, community, and nation. And it devalues human life. Many great cultures have suffered as a result of false standards fostered by the priesthood and so-called religious leaders who have used religion and scripture to feed their own egocentric and selfish philosophies. These people are supposed to be the custodians of culture and religion, but they become caught up in the cult that serves their selfishness instead of propagating the fundamentals of truth. Instead of teaching unity, they teach diversity. Many societal diseases, such as disparity, illiteracy, malnutrition, and discrimination between the poor and rich, the knowledgeable and innocent, have degraded the human being so much that we have forgotten the truth that all human beings breathe the same air supplied by one and the same Lord. No human being has a right to despise and look down on others and make others suffer, and any nation that desires to advance and march forward should first abolish such rules, ideas, customs, and systems that are the main barriers to the integration of the nation. The sense of inferiority and superiority and the resulting complexes are created by human society and not by God. Everyone should have the opportunity to rise, to think freely, and to contribute what he can for the well-being of society. Society generally considers those who performed services to be the lower class, but the Bhagavad Gita teaches that service is the highest of all actions, for it leads to liberation. Those who serve society in a way that others cannot should be adored and respected. There is nothing good or bad as far as work is concerned. Why should one think that a leader is higher than a barber or garbage collector? Such erroneous ideas cause suffering both to the individual and to the whole of society. The Bhagavad Gita integrates different elements of society into one, without which the survival of a society is ultimately at stake. The grouping of people described in the Bhagavad Gita is not meant to create disparity, caste, or rigid categories based on birth in a particular family. That would be opposed to the central theme of this sacred text. Verses 45 and 46.
Sve sve karman yabirataha samsiddhim labhate naraha svakarma niratah siddhim yatha vindati tachrunu yata pravrittir bhutanam yena sarvam idam tatam svakarmana tamabhyarchya siddhim vindati manavaha.
A person attains perfection when absorbed and delighting in his own act. Hear how one who is content in his own actions finds perfection. Worshipping him with his act, he from whom begins all activity of beings, by whom all this is spanned and pervaded, a child of Manu, finds perfection. Verses 45 and 46 are conclusive as far as the caste system is concerned. These verses say that anyone who is sincerely devoted to his own duty is successful. Not only Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, but anyone who is devoted to his duty can attain perfection. The aspirant attains success when he regards his duty as worship to the Supreme Brahman, from whom all human beings spring, and by whose power they are able to do their work. One who surrenders himself with mind, action, and speech, and makes Brahman the goal of his worship, reaches Brahman. The student should remember that self-surrender, when one learns to surrender all that he thinks is his own, is the highest of yogas. Total surrender means total acceptance of the Supreme Self in the place of the individual self. This should not be misunderstood and thus lead one to become inert and lazy, but should instead lead one to do all that can be done for the Lord. The attitude, "I am thine, and thou art mine," is the first step in the practice of self-surrender. The second step is, "Thou art everything," and the last step is, "All that is conceivable and comprehended, all that exists, is thou alone." That state of self-realization is attained by very few, and only by those who have completely surrendered their egos and have realized the beauty and grandeur of the Lord of Life. That realization is beyond I-ness and my-ness. It is timeless and infinite. Verses 47 through 49.
Shreyan swadharmo vigunaha paradharmat swanushtitat swabhava niyatam karma kurvan napnoti kilbisham sahajam karma kaunteya sadosham api natyajet sarvarambahi doshena dhumena agnirivavrutaha asakta buddhya sarvatra jitatma vigataspruhaha naishkarmya siddhim paramam sanyasena adigachati.
Better one's own duty, dharma, even devoid of quality, rather than another's duty, even though well performed. By performing the act determined by nature, one does not gather stain. One should not give up one's inborn act, even though faulty. All endeavors are accompanied by some fault, like fire covered with smoke. One whose intellect is not attached, whose inner instrument is conquered in every way, one whose attraction is gone, attains through renunciation the perfection of actionlessness. Sri Krishna explains that one should always try to understand his own character, abilities, and capacities, and that all duties should be undertaken according to one's own character. One should not abandon his own duty and attempt to do the duty of others. No matter how beneficial it might seem, abandoning one's own duty is unhealthy. If one abandons his duties and takes up the duty of another, there will be serious disorder in society. Good and bad are two values that we project onto circumstances according to our own viewpoints. Though one's natural duty may appear to be tainted with faults, one should realize that all actions are tainted with defects. As fire, which is lustrous, contains smoke, likewise, no action is perfect in itself. One who is completely non-attached and continues to do his duty as best he can, renouncing the fruits of his actions, is a true renunciate. He attains the highest of perfection. Every action in the phenomenal world is defective. No matter how good one's intentions, no action is perfect. If one gives something to another person with love and kindness, that action will produce pain if the object given is lost or broken, or if another person becomes envious. If one wants to practice non-injury and therefore avoids eating meat, he nevertheless must kill plants and other forms of life in order to survive. If Arjuna fights in the Battle of Kurukshetra and becomes victorious, he will help his nation overcome evil, but in the process, he will create immense suffering. One must be courageous and act to the best of his knowledge and ability in spite of the inevitable imperfections of his actions, and he should remain non-attached to the fruits. Verses 50 through 56.
Siddhim prapto yatha brahma tathapnoti nibodhame samase naiva kaunteya nishtha jnanasya yapara buddhya vishuddhaya yukto drutyatmanam niyamyacha shabdadin vishayan stektva ragadveshau vyudasyacha vivikta sevi lagvashi yatavakkaya manasaha dhyana yoga paro nityam vairagyam samupashritaha Ahankaram, balam, darpam, kamam, krodham, parigraham, vimuchya, nirmama, shanto, brahmabhuyaya kalpate. Brahmabhutaha prasannatma nashochati nakankshati. Samaha sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Bhaktya mam abhijanati yavan yaschasmi tattvataha. Tato mam tattvato gnyatva vishate tadanantaram. Sarva karmanyapi sada kurvano madhyapashrayaha matprasada davapnoti shashvatam padamavyayam.
How one, having attained perfection, attains Brahman. Learn from me, as well as the final determination of knowledge. Endowed with purified intelligence, controlling himself with sustenance, dhriti, abandoning the objects of senses, such as sound, and casting away attraction and aversion, enjoying solitary places, eating lightly, with speech, body, and mind controlled, unceasingly intent on the yoga of meditation, having perfect recourse to dispassion, having abandoned ego, pride, passion, and anger, not receiving sense inputs, free of mind, the pacified one is fit to become Brahman. Having become Brahman, with pleasant and clear self, one neither grieves nor desires. Alike toward all beings, he gains the highest devotion toward me. Through devotion, he recognizes me, how expansive, and who I am in reality. Then, knowing me in reality, he enters me immediately. Even performing all the actions at all times depending entirely on me, through my grace, he attains the eternal, imperishable state. Sri Krishna briefly explains how the accomplished yogi attains the highest Brahman. The yogi has to attain many realms of wisdom before he can attain the highest Brahman. In the first step, he learns to develop control over his senses through self-restraint. In the second step, he concentrates the mind, not allowing it to become distracted and dissipated. Next, he makes his mind one-pointed by practicing both meditation and non-attachment. In the next step, he becomes a witness and does not identify himself with the objects of the world. In a still higher stage, he establishes himself in his true nature, peace, happiness, and bliss. At the final state, he realizes his self as the self of all. Each of the stages of wisdom is valuable and is an accomplishment, but the highest of perfection is attained when the individual soul is united with the absolute self. The yogi who has attained that does not suffer as a result of the negative emotions that have such a powerful impact on the minds and hearts of ordinary people. The realized yogi is tranquil, for he has already attained Brahman, and for him, there is nothing more to be attained. He has no desires. His whole life is devoted to the Lord alone. He has profound knowledge through direct experience of the greatness of the Lord, and he remains one with the Lord. Such a yogi performs his actions with an attitude of worship. His whole life is devoted to the Lord, and the eternal becomes his permanent abode. Verses 57 and 58.
Cetasa sarvakarmani mayi sanyasya matparaha buddhi yogam upashritya machittaha satatam bhava. Machitta sarvadurgani matprasadat tarishyasi athachetvam ahankarat nashrosyasi vinakshasi.
Renouncing all acts to me with the mind intent upon me, resorting to the yoga of wisdom, always hold your mind in me. Holding your mind in me, you will go across difficult passages through my grace. If, however, out of ego, you will not listen, you will perish completely. These two verses give instructions to Arjuna, who follows the path of action, not of renunciation. One who follows the path of action should dedicate his thoughts, actions, and speech to the Lord. If one keeps his mind fixed on the Lord, it enables him to give up and offer the fruits of his actions. The aspirant who attains that crosses the mire of delusion through the grace of God. When human endeavor and efforts have been exhausted, then dawns the grace of the descending force of the compassionate Lord of life. But if the aspirant does not follow this path, and instead is caught by his egoism, the purpose of his life is not achieved. Verses 59 and 60.
Yad ahankaram ashritya na yotsya iti manyase, mithyaiva vyavasayaste prakritistvam niyokshyati. Svabhavajena kaunteya nibhadda svena karmana kartum nechasi yenmohat karishyas yavashopitat.
If, resorting to ego, you think, I shall not fight, this, your resolve, is a false one. Nature will impel you. Bound by your nature-born act, O son of Kunti, what you do not wish to do out of confusion, even that you will do helplessly. If one becomes obstinate and thinks that he will not do something that he has to do, he can waste time and he can suffer, but his nature will eventually force him to do it. Although he is a warrior and a leader and a descendant of Bharata, Arjuna withdraws himself from the field of action and wants to retreat. Because he is confused and deluded, he forgets to do his duty and becomes caught up in attachment. But Sri Krishna tells him, "You must perform your duty. You have to do your dharma, and for performing your duty, you must be non-attached, free from pride, prejudice, and the bonds of ego." The aspirant should always remember and follow his inborn nature and potential, with the help of which he should learn to unfold, improve, and accomplish the purpose of life. Often occasions come that lead one to deviate from the path, but then he should again make sincere attempts to tread his path. Every human being is endowed and gifted with some great and profound quality that can be called his inborn nature. If the aspirant does something that he is not meant to do, his inborn nature will compel him to do that for which he is meant. Suppose the aspirant follows the path of renunciation sincerely, with his mind and heart, but becomes distracted along the way. He will invariably come back again to the path, because his deep-seated desire to follow the path of renunciation, motivated by his inborn qualities, will again bring him back to his path. Verses 61 through 63.
Ishvara sarvabhutanam hriddeshe arjuna tishtati. Ramayan sarvabhutani yantrarudhani mayaya. Tameva sharanam gaccha sarvabhavena bharata. Tatprasadat param shantim sthanam prapsyasi shashvatam. Iti te jnanam akhyatam guhyat guhyataram maya. Vimrushyaita dasheshena yathechasi tathakuru.
The sovereign God dwells in the heart space of all beings, O Arjuna, making all beings move with his maya as though they were mounted on a machine. Go and take refuge only in him with your entire being, O descendant of Bharata. By his grace you will attain the highest peace and eternal station. I have taught you this knowledge, more secret than any secret. After contemplating it in entirety, do as you wish. In verse 61, there is a subtle and profound teaching. Sri Krishna says, O Arjuna, the Supreme Lord is the inner dweller in everyone's heart. That the Lord is the inner dweller should be understood by all aspirants. But with that knowledge alone, one cannot directly attain wisdom. He will have to learn to practice to see and realize the Lord himself first. Then he can grasp and comprehend that the Lord dwells in every heart. The mere knowing of a principle is not the same as realizing it. Those who do not realize that the Lord dwells in the hearts of all remain attached to the vehicles of nature. They are compelled as though they are being used as puppets. Therefore, Sri Krishna says, O Arjuna, surrender yourself to the Lord alone, and once you have surrendered, then by grace you can attain the state of tranquility and thus will be liberated. That is the secret of secrets that is imparted to Arjuna. After that secret is imparted, one is left alone to decide for himself what is right for him. When a teacher imparts knowledge, he wants his student to use his free will, to be courageous, and to make experiments to experience, and then to realize what is right for him. Spiritual teachings should not be forced on students as commandments, but there is a commitment between the teacher and the student. And once the teacher has completed his commitment, it is up to the student to choose, practice, and do as he likes. Thus, in the path of spiritual knowledge, 50% of the responsibility lies with the teacher, and 50% with the student. Verses 64 through 66.
Sarva guhyatamam bhuyashrunu me paramam vachah, ishtosi me drudamiti tato vakshyami te hitam. Manmanabhava madbhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru, mame vaishyasi satyam te pratijane priyosi me. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja, aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ashuchah.
Again hear my final words, the most secret of all. You are firmly my favorite. Therefore, I shall say what is beneficial to you. Let your mind be in me. My devotee, sacrificing to me, offer salutations to me. You wilt come only to me truly. I avow you are my beloved. Abandoning all virtue, come and take refuge in me alone. I shall liberate you from all evil. Grieve not. The teacher's love for his student is immense and immeasurable. It is always selfless and of the highest quality. Such love cannot be found in any other relationship in the world. With his immortal love for Arjuna, Sri Krishna says, "Listen to my words of wisdom. I am imparting the secret of secrets because you are my beloved disciple. This is for your good." Students are many, but disciples are rare. A student can join a school and can also leave it. He comes to a spiritual teacher, studies with him for some time, and then leaves forever. But when the spiritual commitment is made by both the teacher and disciple, it is impossible for the teacher not to impart to his disciple all the secrets that he himself has realized. The true disciple always remains eager to learn the subtle secrets that fulfill the purpose of his spiritual commitment. When the disciple learns to fix his mind on the Lord alone and dedicates his entire life to the Lord, he attains the kingdom of eternity, where the Lord resides unattached in his splendid glory. Knowledge of the path of devotion and of the way in which God is attained is a secret imparted only to the very dear disciple. Sri Krishna says, "O Arjuna, forsake all religious works whatsoever, and make the Supreme Lord your final and sole refuge. Grieve not, for you will be free and released from all sins." The 66th verse contains the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. Renounce all actions and come to the Lord alone, for your stains will be washed by the Lord. Ordinarily, if one abandons his duties, he suffers and plunges into sorrow. But if one renounces a lesser duty in order to perform a greater duty, his sin is forgiven. If the cause is higher and more profound than the duty that is abandoned, that duty should be renounced delightfully. Suppose one renounces his home. He will suffer the consequences of renouncing his duties, but he will be free from that suffering if he takes on a duty greater than the duties he was performing before. If one renounces his country for the service of mankind, he is performing a higher duty. And if one renounces everything and devotes all his time and energy to deep and profound meditation and contemplation, he is the highest of all devotees, and his stains are washed off by his pure devotion. Serious questions arise here. Since Arjuna was prepared to renounce the world in the beginning, why was he not allowed to do so? And why is the secrets of secrets, that one should abandon all his duties and that the Lord will wash away all his stains and sins, being imparted here. In the beginning, Arjuna wanted to withdraw himself and to abandon his duty in a state of confusion and despondency. He was not renouncing in a state of wisdom, but in a deep state of sorrow and out of fear, attachment, and confusion. These verses teach the aspirant that the highest of all is that path in which one devotes and dedicates all that he has and all that he is to the Lord. Such a lost lover of the Lord is the highest of all aspirants. Whether he follows the path of renunciation or the path of action, he is liberated here and now, and he enjoys eternal happiness. Verses 67 through 71.
Idam te na tapaskaya na bhaktaya kadachana, na cha shushrushave vachyam, na cha mam yobhyasuyati. Ya idam paramam guhyam madbhaktesh vabhidhasyati, bhaktim mai param krutva, mame vaishyatya saunshaya. Nacha tasman manushyeshu kaschin me priyakrittamaha bhavita nacha me tasmad anya priyatarobhuvi. Adhyeshyate cha ya imam dharmyam samvadam avayoho, jnana yajnena tenaham ishta syamiti me mati. Shraddhavan anasuyascha shrunuyadapi yonaraha, sopi muktaha shubhan lokan prapnuyat punyakarmanam.
This should never be taught by you to a non-ascetic or a non-devotee, nor to someone inattentive, nor to one who defames me. He who narrates this supreme secret to my devotees, completing his highest devotion toward me, will come to me alone, without doubt. Among human beings, there is no one who causes me greater pleasure, nor shall there be anyone more beloved of me on earth than one who will read this virtuous dialogue that has occurred between us. Let him sacrifice unto me with the sacrificial observance of knowledge. This is my view. Endowed with faith and without calumny, whichever human would hear this, even he, liberated, would obtain the beautiful worlds of those with meritorious acts. The great sages like to impart their knowledge to their loving disciples. Their teachings are called secret knowledge because they cannot be comprehended by the ordinary mind. The teacher imparts such knowledge to his close disciples only. It would be a waste of time and energy to impart such knowledge to those who are not prepared, for it would be like Greek or Latin to them. There is no reason to discuss the spiritual depths with those who are not at all proficient in the path of spirituality. The supreme secrets of spiritual knowledge are imparted only to the dear and true devotees who have already trodden the path and who have still to attain. One who imparts the knowledge of devotion and dedication to those weary, tired, and old travelers who are on the path but still stumbling is dear to the Lord. Such teachings help both the teacher and the student. The greatest of all professions is the teaching profession, and among all the branches of knowledge, spiritual teaching is the highest. Among the many spiritual paths, the path of complete devotion and dedication is the highest. Thus, the teacher who imparts his spiritual knowledge is the highest of all teachers. Teaching spirituality is the highest of actions and is pleasing to the Lord of life. There is no one higher than the sage who propagates the truth lovingly and selflessly. One who studies, practices and propagates the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna with all his heart and mind is the greatest of all devotees. By studying and practicing the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, one is in fact worshipping the Supreme Lord. One who listens to the discourse of the Bhagavad Gita with unquestioned faith is a holy man. Such a man becomes free from stains and fears. One who contemplates on the teachings imparted through the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna is released from bondage and attains a high state of spirituality. Among all the offerings made by human beings, the sacrifice that is made by imparting the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita is the highest of all. The knowledge imparted by the Bhagavad Gita is beneficial for all people in all times. Verses
72 and 73. Arjuna vacha, nashto moha smrutir labdha tvat prasadan mayachuta sthitosmi gata sandeha karishye vachanam tava.
Did you perchance hear this, O son of Pritha, with a one-pointed mind? Did your delusions of ignorance perchance vanish, O Arjuna? Arjuna said, the delusion has vanished by your grace. I have received remembrance, O infallible one. I stand here free of doubts. I shall act according to your word. Throughout the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, it has been Arjuna who has asked the questions. But here, Sri Krishna asks questions of Arjuna. Is your delusion dispelled? Has your ignorance vanished? As a result of knowledge imparted by me, are all your questions answered? Or is there still doubt lingering in your mind? Arjuna replies, O enlightened one, my ignorance has been dispelled, and my doubts have been resolved by the teachings you have imparted to me. I have no doubt in my mind, and no conflict about doing my duties. I will fight with all my might. You have inspired me, and I have regained my inner strength. I will perform my duties according to my dharma. Now I am able to perform them skillfully and selflessly, without any attachment. Those like Arjuna who plunge into sorrow and delusion lose their memories of their true nature and of the source from which they came. But Sri Krishna has led Arjuna to the awareness of that which he had forgotten. Arjuna now realizes his unity with the self of all. Verses 74 through 78.
Sanjaya Uvacha. Ityaham Vasudevasya Parthasya cha Mahatmanah Samvadamimam Ashrausham Adbutam Romaharshanam Vyasa Prasadat Shrutavan Etat Guhyam Aham Param Yogam Yogeshwarat Krishnat Sakshat Kathayatasvayam Rajan Samsmritya Samvadamimam Adbutam Keshavarjunayo Punyam Hrishyami cha Muhurmuhu Tatcha samsmritya samsmritya rupam atyadbhutam harehe vismayo me mahan rajan rishyami cha punah punah yatra yogeshwara krishno yatra partho dhanurdhara tatra shrir vijayo bhutir dhruva nitir matir mama.
Sanjaya said, I heard this wondrous dialogue, making my hair stand on end, between the indwelling one and the great-souled son of Pritha. By the grace of Vyasa, I heard this secret-most, supreme yoga from Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, personally teaching it himself. O King, remembering again and again this wondrous, virtuous dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, I rejoice again and again. And remembering that very wondrous form of the Lord, there is great amazement in me, O Lord, and I rejoice again and again. Where there is Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, and where there is the bow-bearer, son of Pritha, there glory, victory, success, and polity are definite. This I believe. Sanjaya, the narrator of the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, speaks to King Dhritarashtra. The compiler of this dialogue is the sage Vyasa, who gave the power of vision to Sanjaya, enabling him to narrate what occurs on the battlefield. Sanjaya says, O Dhritarashtra, I have heard the supreme and profound wisdom and the knowledge of life and the universe and that which is beyond from the master of yoga. I am describing it to you exactly as I heard it. When I recall these profound teachings, my hair still stands on end. With great joy I saw the vision of the Lord of the universe, and the joyous and delightful memory of that experience is still with me. I firmly assert that where there is a great hero like Arjuna and a perfect yogi like Sri Krishna helping him, that side is sure to be forever victorious in all ways. The dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna gives deep insight into the philosophy of life and its practical application. These teachings describe the eternal wisdom of the Infinite Lord and the ways in which that wisdom can be attained. When a good student has a perfect preceptor, attainment is sure. Here ends the profound and unique teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. In this concluding chapter, Yogeshwar Krishna imparts the art and science of renunciation.
The end.